All right, listeners, before we get into this week's podcast, I just want to thank our sponsor, Airship Notebooks. They're sponsoring us for the month of March. And artists know that details matter. Whatever you're creating, the details set great art apart. So when Airship Notebooks set out to create their Alpha Sketch Notebook, they paid attention to every little thing. It's 100% recycled paper, beautifully handles pencil, marker, and even watercolor, or whatever other medium you choose. The Alpha Sketchbook's brilliant lay-flat binding is not only more comfortable and convenient, it lets you spread your creativity across the entire two-page landscape. It's all that helps artists and designers, you know, people like you, be more creative and more productive. Here's one more thing for our listeners. You can go to airshipnotebooks.com right now, enter coupon code INEBRIART, INEBRIART 30, and you'll get 30% off your entire order. This offer is valid during the entire month of March, so grab it while you can. And thank you again to Airship Notebooks for sponsoring the Inebriart podcast and all our events. Welcome back, Inebriarts. This is Andy, the Inebriart Podcast, and I am once again recording from my home due to the current state of affairs. And like I said, that gives us the ability to reach out to people we don't normally get to interview in our area. And I have with me, I'm going to do my best, man, Rishi?
Yeah. Rishi.
From Elephant Stone, excuse me. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, anytime. So you guys are really unique because I think you tend to incorporate instruments that us here in kind of the United States and Canada don't normally get in music. Like you use a sitar, is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's kind of my main instrument in some ways. Yeah.
So what brought that about? Is that the music instrument you started on, or?
No, I mean, I'm Indian, first of all, I guess that's the biggest part. And, I grew up on like, I have an older brother, so he raised me on like the Who and the Beatles and stuff like that. And my parents kind of just fed me Bollywood music, like old Indian film music. So growing up with that, I mean, I'd hear a bunch of stuff, and it wasn't until, 1997 on a family trip to India. I was in India and I was like, well, what am I going to bring back? I'm like, I'll buy a sitar. So, yeah. So I bought a kind of a crappy student sitar and messed around with it for a few years. And it wasn't, then in 2000, I found a teacher. Because the thing with sitar, it's like, it can be self-taught, but you're going to mess it up.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's not easy to find a teacher, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can. I remember I bought these like teacher self sitar books. This was like in the late 90s. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't YouTube or anything like that, really. Right. So it was really like I had to really look these pictures and books. I'm like, how do I do that?
Yeah.
And I try to copy like Ravi Shankar recordings I have. And stuff. But no, yeah, but yeah, the sitar, that's been my thing for a few decades now.
And has that been something that you've always tried to incorporate into your music, or just Elephant Stone itself?
Yeah. Well, when I got it, I was in this. I've been in bands since like the mid-90s. I mean, I was in this like kind of like a modish '60s band, and so I remember I was the bassist in that band, and I tried incorporating sitar. And I remember the first time we played live with the sitar. I didn't know how to mic it. So my singer had an acoustic guitar pickup and we taped it to my sitar.
Yeah.
And it's funny, we never actually tried it out in soundcheck or in rehearsal.
So you just kind of, you know, went on a night kind of thing.
So when it came to the moment I was supposed to play the sitar, I sat on the ground stage. We used to wear suits. I was wearing a suit.
Yeah.
And I started playing and nothing was happening. Then everyone was like, be quiet. And that didn't work. And then my buddy came with a microphone and he's like, putting up Satari, it was a mess. And anyways, I've come a long way from there. But yeah, I mean, before I just tried, I didn't know much about it. I didn't really understand what it really meant. And it was only in 2000, 2001 when I found my teacher. Mm-hmm. And I started studying it seriously and studying Indian classical music that I actually began to really understand what it was. And it wasn't until I left my old band and I started Elephant Stone in 2006, 2007, where the sitar was supposed to be the focus. And yeah, now I try to incorporate as much as I can.
You know, and it's weird. It's like, it's almost one of those things. Like I drive a Mini Cooper and I've only been driving it for about a year, but like the second I got behind the wheel, it's like you see them everywhere. So when you started playing it in a band, did you start to see other bands that you never saw before that have been playing that type of instrument? Or
I think in the past few years, I mean, like there's bands like Kikagakumoyo from Japan and stuff like that. The people that do it, I mean, with like definitely psychedelic music, started kind of. That became a thing in like...
Well, like in the 60s and stuff. Didn't the Beatles kind of like mess around with it a little
bit? Yeah. I mean, the Beatles, the Stones, Donovan, all those guys in the 60s used it. And then it kind of got... It wasn't the flavor of the day anymore. But in the 2000s, I mean, the whole psych rock scene started coming up again. Like with bands like Black Angels, Tame Impala, Brian Jones, Hem Asker and stuff. So definitely these days, I mean... We just did a European tour and I'm meeting a lot of guys that are like, oh, I started playing sitar because of you. I'm like, really?
And oh,
like,
that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was neat. It's nice. I mean, the band's Elephant Stone's been kicking around for like over 10 years now. So definitely we're not like a big band by any means, but you know.
Well, you still toured Europe. I mean, that's not a small band either. Where did you go overseas?
Yeah, we did. We went to all the COVID-19 hotspots.
Like, oh, awesome.
No, my wife was saying, because I got back into town. We're in Montreal, and we got back into town in mid-February.
Oh, man, so, like right in the thick of things, yeah.
No, we got back to Montreal February 16th, and like I was in Spain, I was in France, I was in Germany, I was in the UK, Netherlands, Belgium, I was all around there. And just when we got back, I mean, we didn't really hear much about what was going on, and it was only after... like a week later, I started hearing about it. I'm like, wow, I was really lucky because we were in Spain for a few days and we that was our first European tour in a couple of years. We were kind of laying low for a bit.
That's a memorable one.
it's too bad because I mean, the album, our last album just came out. It came out on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
February 14th. And so this was supposed to be busy year. I was supposed to head down to South by Southwest. I was supposed to head on a US tour in a couple of weeks. And now it's, you know, I'm in my studio now and just creating stuff, which is great, but you know, I kind of want to get back out there. But
right. I mean, that's kind of why we're taking advantage of this time to like reach out to people and be like, hey, who's got canceled plans and what's the
I'm doing a lot of Zoom meetings and live streaming stuff these days.
I feel like a lot of musicians are doing the live streaming thing. How has been the response with that? Are you getting good crowds or? You
know, yeah. Well, like- I remember cause I started this thing called the Sacred Sound Sessions. I've done two so far. I remember the first one was really heavy because like in Montreal, we started the lockdown, May 13th. And so I did my first live streaming just about a week into that. And I remember it was like, you were kind of scared. You didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
You didn't know how long it's going to last. And I remember when I did the session, it was like very emotional because like, you know, it's a conversation because people are giving feedback and you're like, wow, we're all in this together. And it was beautiful because it made me feel like I connected with people again.
Right.
And
that
everyone is like, you and I are going through the exact same thing right now. You know, it's the one common thread between all of humanity in some ways at this moment. So it's the live streaming is nice. The fact that I feel like I am doing a public service that I'm people are writing, this is like therapy in some ways, you know, like I'll be playing sitar, I'll play a bunch of my songs. I did a cover and stuff, and it's nice. It's been an actually really nice experience, but now it's becoming a bit more like work.
Cause
I was like, I was going to do it every week, but I think I just need to make it like a monthly thing now.
Do you feel that, interacting with the crowd that way, I feel like it would be different because, you know, if you're in a club or whatever, and there's a crowd and someone yells something, you wouldn't necessarily hear it, but where it's a live stream chat, you could read every comment that everybody
Well, you could not read the comments, I guess.
Or you could not. Yeah, I suppose. Depending on no, what but, you're saying.
But it was interesting on this last European tour I did, it's funny because I, in the past year, I made this conscious decision to, after a show, to go to the merch booth and talk to people. Usually I would go backstage and just hide out. But this time, the past year, I've been going out and shaking people's hands. And so for this European tour, I was out there hugging people, shaking their hands and stuff. And only after I
Oh, you definitely have it.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I'm like, so I've been okay.
Either that or you have a natural born immunity or something.
Exactly.
So how is it more difficult working? No, I'm saying sitar and you're saying it's slightly different. So is that,
sorry?
I'm saying sitar. Is that,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Is it more difficult working that in to a standard, you know, quote unquote rock band? Like how do people like, do people kind of have to warm up to it? Or are they like, what is this?
Oh dear. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Like you, there's people that hate sitar, even if they don't know what it is, they hate it.
Yeah.
And then there's people that love it, that say it like sends them to an astral plane or something. I mean, I love it. Songwriting, it's taken a while. I mean, cause especially in a live setting when we're on stage, like loud guitars, drums, bass, keyboards, the sitar cuts through. It's got this very sharp sound that kind of cuts through everything, and it's, you know, it's easy to use it in a kitschy fashion, but I try not to. I mean, I do make like psychedelic music.
Yeah.
So the sitar, the droniness of it, the harmonics really suits well our songs.
It strangely reminds me of a bagpipe.
Yeah. Well,
like,
no,
it makes a constant sound.
Exactly. Yeah. It's got the drone. Yeah. Yeah. But it's easier to be in pitch on a sitar than a bagpipe.
Well, I'm sure. And you're not going to, you know, pass out from lack of oxygen.
Yeah. No, but it's funny though, because like Celtic music and Indian music, there's a connection there. I mean, the drone, it's such a prominent thing in those two types of music. So it's.
Yeah. Do you, work in other instruments that are native to India?
I have tablas on the record, harmonium, dilruba. It's this weird. It's a bowed Indian instrument. It looks like kind of like a mini sitar.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about.
And yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I remember on one record, I didn't know anyone that played it. So I'm like, oh, I can play it. Oh, yeah. It was a mess. It was a hard recording session. Just to, like playing a bowed instrument is very different than playing like a plucked instrument and like a guitar, sitar. So yeah.
And so when you're kind of locked down working on music and stuff, how do you normally write music? Do you do it as a complete band, or do you kind of do individual stuff and then bring it together? And is this method of working kind of stuck at home more difficult or kind of the norm?
I'm kind of a loner in some ways. I like being on my own. I have three kids and a wife, and we're stuck here together, but but I have my studio. So, you know, like the songwriting process is usually I pick up a guitar and then wait for something to happen. Like you never go into it with a premeditated idea. It's like, I'll go to my piano or I'll go to guitar and pick it up, play a chord, then I'll play another chord, then it'll set something off. I'll come up with a melody and it'll just unravel itself that way immediately over a few days. And then what do I do then? I keep building the song in my head. I keep playing my wife parts and she's like, is that good? Is that good? She's like, yeah, it's all right. Or if she loses attention, she's like, no. And I keep doing that. And eventually, what's happening now that I'm stuck at home all the time, I'm playing a lot more drums.
Yeah.
So I have my 9-to-5 job. So I actually work from home now. and my lunch break, I just play drums. So I'm working on a new album now, I think it's just going to be all me. Like, I have my, like, Miles, our drummer, I've been playing with him for, since 2012. So it's been like 8 years. You know, he's my drummer, but right now I'm kind of like the idea of doing like the isolation sessions, you know, like kind of like doing this album where I'm playing everything, even if it won't be perfect, it'll be a time capsule of the time. So,
oh yeah, it'll be very distinct too.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting for me at least. And I'm not a great drummer, but it's going to be functional,
but it'll
be something I can look back at this time 10 years from now and go, yeah, I made that record when I couldn't leave home.
So you said you work a 9-to-5 job. Is it difficult coordinating like a European tour with a 9-to-5 job? I mean, it sounds like they'd be pretty understanding to just use vacation time or something.
No. Yeah. I mean, no, it's great. Cause I'm I'm a technical writer. That's been my day job for years. And it kind of doing that kind of, it's, allows me to take time off and go on tour, then come back and catch up on work. So yeah, I'm pretty fortunate that way, in that I have this, my life is set up that I could support my family and pursue my,
my interests. Is that by design or just kind of, that's how it happened?
No, it's definitely by design. I mean, it's funny. So in Canada, we'll give you the lowdown. So in Canada, sure. When you have kids, there's a maternity leave and parental leave and paternity leave in Canada. So the government will actually pay you like up to 75% of your salary when you have a kid. And you can take a few weeks off to spend time with your family. So my wife stayed at home with a kid. So I actually took the time off from my job.
Oh, nice.
And I actually spent it, this is years ago. This is like when we had our first kid in 2009, that I took the time off, I recorded a record, and I went on tour. So I did stuff like that. And so I was trying to make my life sustainable in a way, but then we're not going to keep pumping out kids. And it just happened that
if every time you have a kid, you immediately go on tour, your wife's going to resent that eventually.
every kid did result in a record. So.
Yeah.
By design and just by, you know, I mean, if you're motivated to make something happen, you can make it happen. And
I think that's kind of part of that creative mindset, where even if you are stuck in that confines of a, you know, like I work 9-to-5 in a cubicle normally, not a furloughed, but you find ways to make it work, and you kind of, you know, make adjustments, and you find that job that is that little bit flexible where you can like duck out a little early or whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, anybody can make excuses why things aren't working or why you can't do what you want to do in life. But I remember I made this, I was in this band, the Black Angels, back in 2012, and we were in Australia. We're on tour in Australia playing this festival, and Beck was on that bill.
Oh, nice.
So I saw Beck play, and he played Loser.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, he's like, where's the sitar? He needs the sitar. And we were doing Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. This is in Melbourne. And then I was watching it play, and I told my buddy, I'm like, 1 week today in Sydney, I'm going to be playing sitar with Beck. And he's like, how are you going to do that? I'm like, I'm going to make it happen. And I just convinced myself I'd make it happen. I'm like, well, why not? Why would I not be on stage playing sitar with Beck?
Well, who else is going to do it?
Yeah, exactly. And then a week later, I was on stage with Beck. I mean, like half an hour. I got in through tour manager friends. I knew each other. I kept asking around. And half an hour before a set, his manager found me. I met Beck. We went back to his trailer. We ran through the song once. Then I was on stage half an hour later. And then I did the next night in Brisbane. And then he came to Montreal and I played with him again. And all this to say, I remember that moment after Brisbane. I'm like that was a big career highlight for me. I remember the morning after the Brisbane show, I was just walking around. And I was like, wow. It's like, I made that happen.
Yeah.
I made that happen because I willed it to be. And because of that, after that moment, that's kind of been my attitude in life and everything I do. Just if you really think you can make something happen, it'll happen. So.
Yeah. And you know, I've had a lot of people ask me, they're like, how did you get this person on the podcast? I'm like, I just asked.
Yeah, I mean, you can't be afraid to put yourself out there. I mean, it's like when I'm doing these live streaming things. I mean, I'm just doing it because what do I have to lose, you know? And if there's one or two people that actually they connect with it and they feel something, you know, that's a beautiful thing. It's like anything when you create art.
Yeah.
Even if it's just one person, you made a difference in one person's life.
Oh, absolutely. It's that unexpected feedback that you get from someone that.
Yeah. I mean, like this European tour, like I'd go and one guy's like, I started playing sitar because of you. Like he heard the album 7 years ago and they bought a sitar and it's cool. And like people write me like for a while on tour, it's been a couple of years, but I was giving sitar lessons, like, cause I knew people don't have sitar teachers in their towns and
right.
Like small, somewhere like middle of nowhere, Germany. So if people wanted a sitar lesson, I wrote people. I put it on my website. So people reached out and after soundcheck, I'd give them a sitar lesson. Just the fact.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's just something I can give people that not many people can.
Have you ever contemplated doing either like YouTube videos for like starting sitar?
Yeah. Well, I know I did a bunch with the CBC like 3 years ago. There's like these nice looking videos and I think it's like one of the main sitar tuning videos.
Oh, really?
And there's a lot of trolls out there that like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
This is, I'm like, whatever.
Those are the comments you don't read.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. That's the ones that everyone wants to read though. You know, it's like, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's a bad one.
Yeah. One of our other podcasts, we actually feature when we get hit, you know, hate mail or bad feedback, you know. We make sure we bring them out and discuss it. And,
oh, really?
I mean, yeah. It's, you know, someone's still listening. And I have no issue if someone says something instructive, you know.
Like, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
the audio's not great or this one was boring or, you know, these, you know, you should ask these type of questions or whatever. Just the ones that are like, you guys suck. You know, you're like,
yeah,
it's not even constructive.
I know, I like when people, like, I love reading reviews of my albums just because I'm curious to see what people say, and the bad ones especially.
Yeah.
And even though I'll be like, oh, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about, I'm like, oh, maybe there's something valid to it. I mean, at this point, I've made, how many albums? In my career, I made 11 records or something in my life, and each one needs to be kind of a growth from the other one, and I think people's criticisms do help in the end,
sure.
Ultimately.
Yeah, I find my daughter is my harshest critic. She will just like be like, "This is wrong," and you'll look and you're like, "Damn it!"
She listens to your podcast.
She like because I draw, so like she'll look at my.
Oh, phone, okay.
She'd be like,
okay,
"That cool. arm is not the same size as the other arm." You'd be like, "Damn it!"
You're like, "Neither is yours."
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, "You're adopted."
You're the poo-poo head.
Yeah, actually, my son listens to the podcast pretty regularly. So, but my kids are probably older than yours. So. But do your kids show inclination to music?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, my daughter, she sang on the fact that I recorded the last album at home. She sang on 3 songs.
Oh, okay. I don't know why I was under the impression your kids were very little.
So. No, my kids are 10. 8 and 4.
Oh, okay. All right.
So she sang on the album and I just, we did a Sacred Sound Sessions and I had my daughter and my son come sing. My son doesn't, he's a huge music fan.
Yeah.
He knows the lyrics to so many Beatles songs, but he doesn't have the best pitch. He's a little tone deaf, but he's a great dancer. So if you watch the Sacred Sound Sessions 2, he's got great dance moves, but he's not singing. He's kind of just going miming along.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. My son just got into the Beatles himself, but he's...
With no direction from you, just...
No, just kind of, you know, he's like, oh, you know, I've been listening to the Beatles a lot, and we'll send, like, YouTube videos back and forth.
How old is he?
He's going to be turning 18. He got me into this band out of New York called Too Many Zoos.
Okay.
And they started off in the subway, and it's like a trumpet, sax, and percussion, you know, trio. great stuff if you get a chance to check it out. And, you know, I'll send him some older stuff, but his music tastes are all over the road. You know, from when he was little, like one of his favorite things is Alice Cooper. And I think most of his early music taste came from watching The Muppet Show. So.
As a soul.
Yeah. So you were planning to tour the U.S.
And yeah.
Obviously you had to put that off for a bit. Where were you headed? What were you looking forward to? I'm assuming it's not your first U.S. tour.
No. Yeah, we did the West Coast at the end of last year, but this was supposed to be like a East Coast, Midwest. We were going to all like from New York to Milwaukee. And yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a downer, but it was funny because like we didn't officially postpone the tour is just postponed for now. It's not canceled, but it's a very interesting time for the live music industry. Interesting and dark. Just the fact that everyone's trying to kind of like, okay, we're planning for the fall.
Yeah. And everything's kind of in this weird holding pattern.
Yeah. Where,
like you don't want to cancel an event till you absolutely have to, but the same aspect, you can't really promote it the same way that you normally would.
Yeah. No, it's hard. I mean, it just feels we're all kind of like holding our breath going, is it over yet? Every morning I wake up, I'm like, is it over yet? I'm like, nope. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's keep doing it. I mean, the tour is going to be like a couple weeks. It was going to be short, but I was looking forward to South by Southwest. We had a nice run there. And we had like 9 or 10 shows in like 5 days or something.
Yeah.
So it was going to be busy. It was going to be, you know, it was just good. I mean, it's just funny, like putting out an album, putting all these resources behind it, like publicists, then all your booking agents are putting their time and effort to book a tour.
You're right.
And you're getting mentally prepared, you're doing your part. And then it just all kind of collapses and you're kind of angry and frustrated, but then the reality of what's happening hits you. They're like, well, that was a no-brainer.
Right, yeah. I mean, you have
that choice. Yeah, I remember because when South by Southwest got canceled, a lot of people were like, we're still going to do the unofficial showcases for all the bands out, because bands tour down South by Southwest. So there's hundreds of bands on the road in the U.S. heading to Austin. Mm-hmm. So they were still going to do showcases, but then at one point they're like, wait a minute, this is really irresponsible and we're putting people's lives at risk.
Right.
And then everything just shut down. And
it literally went from 60 to zero, I should say, in a matter of a day.
I remember when, before the lockdown happened here, I remember my wife was picking my kids up from school and she was just talking to another mom about it. And then it's like, oh yeah, you know, you're going to come take the kids to school, it might be closed. And then the next day was just like, everyone worked from home. School shut down till God knows when.
Yeah.
We're homeschooling or doing our best. You know.
Yeah. My kids are doing that. I mean, like I said, my son's turning 18. This was his final year. He was graduating.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, I don't know if they're having a graduation ceremony or what the story is, but, you know, he was in the last months as a senior, so it's like he was kind of on coasting anyways.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, all right, I don't have to go to school.
Whatever.
But that's why now's the time to just create art. Even if I don't release anything, the fact is like learn a new skill or anything or refine your craft, right?
Yeah, and it just keeps you, you know, loose and kind of, you know, like an athlete, you'd still have to exercise. And,
yeah, exactly. You know. I heard about the NHL might be doing the playoffs, but like these guys haven't skated in like weeks.
Really? Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure they're working out, but you know, they're not going to be in game shape.
No, they're not going to be in game shape.
That's going to be terrible. Yeah. Are you a Montreal fan?
I mean, you can say
yes, and I won't edit it out of the podcast.
Oh no. Well, I mean, I'm not a hockey fan much. It's just like growing up in Montreal it's all the Canadians all the time. Like that's religion. That's our religion in Montreal. Right. Like, you're Canadians fans. So I've grown up in this environment where it's all hockey all the time, and I've kind of blocked it out. But you can't help but not be aware of it because that's
what everyone talks about. Yeah,
and it runs through everyone's blood here. So. It's just, but right now everyone's home, so.
Yeah, New England, it's kind of like whatever team is doing the best.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it's been all Brady talk about the Patriots.
Yeah.
So
I
think when the lockdown was happening, he was signing with a new team, and it's like it was 50-50. It was either COVID-19 or Brady talk. And there was no other conversations. Yeah. So kind of getting back to music, you said that you were like into the Beatles and some Bollywood music growing up. What other bands kind of got you where you are today? Like,
Okay. I mean, I grew up on, like, my brother would make me cassettes of, like, Boston, the Beatles, the Doors.
Make you cassettes. That is a super old statement.
I have this memory. My brother made a mixtape of The Who's Meaty, Beaty, Big and Bouncy and the Best of the Doors.
Yeah.
A-side was one album. The other side, flip side, was the other one.
And you'd have to put it on, like, super long play.
Yeah. And, but we would play Leisure Suit Larry and Police Quest, listening to those albums over and over. So I think The Who and the Beatles were my big thing. I remember when I was a kid, my brother convinced me, I think it wasn't when I was 8, he convinced me Taxman was actually called Batman. So I would just, every time the chorus would come along, I'd be like, Batman. So, and I tried to do that to my kids. I get to do this then, but they were like, no, it's Taxman, listen.
Yeah, well, that's because you're listening on an audio tape where it was the audio quality's not great. Yeah,
they're like, Alexa, play Taxman. But I grew up on that. I mean, teenager, I remember first time hearing Nirvana.
Yeah,
I mean, my brother was on some Metallica, Guns N' Roses, and stuff. I was into that too. I mean, I saw them play a bunch of times when I was a kid. But Nirvana came along, and that was a big thing. I remember. The radio station here, Shom, wouldn't play Nirvana because it was a classic rock station. So they had someone from the record label picketing outside the radio station in diapers.
Really?
And I remember the DJ saying, fine, we'll play it. And I remember they played it. Like, we'll be playing Smells Like Teen Spirit at like 10 o'clock on Saturday night. And my brother played it.
It was such a huge, influential song.
I just remember my brother recorded it. And I was in bed, and then the next morning he's like, you got it. Come here. He's like, listen to this. And he played it on his tape deck, and I was like, whoa. And remember, I think I listened to it like 13 times in a row. And from there, Teenage Fan Club, Soundgarden, Mudhoney. I got into the whole Seattle thing.
Yeah.
And then the Kinks and all that stuff, all the mod stuff, 60s stuff, Pink Floyd, Motown, soul music.
See, I think I went from, like, the grunge stuff in high school, and then when I was in art school, I got into, like, the industrial stuff out of Chicago with, like, Ministry.
Oh, wow.
And, you know.
Okay, yeah. I was always a bit terrified, like, from Ministry, but I had the album. I remember when videos come on, I'd be like, oh, man, that's intense stuff.
Yeah, very dark stuff, yeah.
Yeah, no, we had a great show in Montreal called Rage.
Okay.
It used to also be called New Music. This guy named Claude Rajet. He was amazing. I think it was every Sunday night for an hour, he would like curate all like alternative music. So you'd hear Nine Inch Nails, you'd hear Ministry, then you'd hear Teenage Fan Club, you'd hear My Bloody Valentine. So it was on the commercial rock station, but you get this one, and I'd record it every Sunday.
Yeah.
And then on the Friday, he would do the video version on Music Plus, which is like our MTV in Quebec. Mm-hmm. And same thing, he'd play like the Pixies. And I remember that's how I discovered so much music, like the Afghan Whigs. And like my whole taste as a teenager was because of this guy. He's kind of a legend. He's kind of a legend here. And those are different days. I mean, you had to find these people that had their ear to the ground, right?
Yeah.
And they would be the gatekeeper of good music for you. But now it's not like that, you know?
It's weird now because I feel like, you know, back in our day.
Yeah, no, sure.
But like you would listen to, like you tune into a program like that because you would want to hear the Pixies or you'd want to hear Soundgarden or whoever it was. And then you would listen through the other songs to get to the other band you want to hear. But that's where you discover the new music.
Exactly.
I feel like you almost have to actively search out. I want to find new music today and sit down and find new music because it just doesn't have, like, it's not put in front of you like it used to be.
Maybe that's why they call Gen Xers lazy, because just they kind of like you're waiting for music, and then just waiting for the next song to come, and they discover all this other music. You're like, oh, that's actually kind of cool. Maybe I'll check that out. And but now it's like, you know, it's I don't know. I don't like my kids. Like, you know, I don't tell them what to listen to, but I'm like, oh, you should listen to check out Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah,
listen to the Beatles. Check out the Zombies. And yeah, I mean, who knows when they're when they became teenagers, what it's going to be like. I mean, I look at like I
get my the music into their head or something.
Yeah, stream into their room directly into their brain. But yeah, I don't know. But I remember that you really had to, you know, that back then you could have your favorite back in our day, you could have your favorite band that no one ever heard of. You know?
Oh yeah, that it was like your band.
Yeah, your band. And it was like, oh. Like, and I just remember you had to work so hard to find music, and I don't know. It's just funny. I mean, I love it now. I mean, I love the fact that I can listen to whatever I want, whenever I want. And I've discovered so much great music that kind of slipped through the fingers years ago just by playlists. And so it's neat. I mean, I'm always listening to music now, just the fact that it's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that I love about YouTube is you can somehow stumble across a band and then be like, holy crap, they have like 40,000 followers and like 30 videos and they were on Lollapalooza and I've never heard of them. And
yeah, exactly.
And you have to actively do it, but you can still find them.
Yeah. Cause they say that YouTube's the biggest music discovery tool out there.
Yeah. Anyone that recently that you've come across that you've gotten into?
Recently, I don't know. I discovered this guy Emmett Rhodes from the '70s. I mean, it's interesting actually because he recorded all his records by himself. Like he did everything.
Was he on lockdown too?
No, I think he was just a bit. I think he's a bit crazy.
Yeah,
but he kind of sounds like early McCartney albums, and he's great. He writes great pop songs. And I remember it was like a little gem I discovered through a playlist. But it's funny now that I'm looking to start playing everything myself. I do think of Emmett Rhodes. I'm like, well, he did it. Maybe I can do it too. So
yeah, and I mean with the ability to, you know, edit your own music and
it's
just like, such a different world.
It's a different world. I mean, yeah. I mean, ambition kind of is more important than talent.
I feel like that's always been the way because there's always been those acts where you're like, how are they popular?
Yeah, exactly. But they just keep pushing. And, you know, like for myself, like I'm not the greatest singer. I'm not the greatest songwriter. I'm not the greatest anything, but I do have my thing. And now with all these tools, I can kind of make what I'm hearing in my head, I can kind of present it kind of watered down to like the people in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of that is, like when I was a kid, I wanted to be a comic book artist. And I remember there was one specific guy that, I mean, just everyone like tore apart because he was not particularly good, but always worked.
Yeah.
And as an adult, I found out it's because he hit his deadlines. He always hit his deadlines. And from a business standpoint, they would rather someone mediocre hit their deadlines than someone who's awesome, who's never there.
Yeah, I'm very punctual. That's the thing, like, because I work with so many musicians, and then a lot of people are just like, they never know when enough is enough.
Yeah.
And when they're done. Like, you're never, like anything, you're never really finished a song. A song is never complete.
Right.
It's just at one point you have to be like, this is as far as it's going to go. I need to just move on. You could work like, you know, like Kevin Shields, My Bloody Valentine, like he'll just work on a record forever because he's never happy. And so I don't think I'm a perfectionist that way. I just, I take it as far as, I don't know, I have a limit where I'm like, I'm done with this. I need to move on to something else.
And that's such a tricky thing to kind of, because I mean, you want to put out the absolute best thing you can put out, but at the same point, if you're never done, it never gets out.
Yeah, but it's like, what is the best? What is the best? You know, like, who knows? Like, I put out my last record, and I think it's a good record, but I've kind of already moved on from that. And I don't know if it's the best thing I've done. it's like, you never know. I mean, it's all relative, and you just have to keep making art, I think. And that's kind of where my head is right now. I mean, especially having my own studio, I just have to keep making it. And yeah. I've known so many friends over the years, because I've been doing this for like 20 plus years now. I've had friends that are like, oh yeah, I'm done with music. And I'm like, what do you mean you're done with music? I don't understand that.
Right.
That's like, it's everything. If, to me, it's everything. I mean, how could you just say you're done with it? And I don't understand that. Yeah.
No, I totally get that. I mean, 'cause it's like, how do you walk away from something that's been a part of your, you know, such a part of your life?
Yeah. I remember growing up, 'cause like, it's funny, growing up in the Indian community, like my parents would have parties when I was like a teenager, and my uncles, like these are like the Indian community. Mm-hmm. They'd come and they'd be drinking their whiskeys. And then the
it
uncle
sounds very much like an Irish community.
He's he'd be like, Rishi, he's like, when do you want to give up on this music thing?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, uncle, you know, and you know, it's, you know, I like joining. He's like, do something serious. Like I watched Blinded by the Light. Have you seen that movie?
No.
It's this British film. It's about this Indian kid that grows up in the 80s.
And he's trying to be like Bruce Springsteen?
Well, he's an aspiring writer.
Okay.
And he discovers Springsteen, and then he really connects with Springsteen's lyrics and music. And he grows up in this kind of conservative Pakistani household where the dad's like, writing is no future, that's no career. And I'm watching with my kids, and my kids are like, Dad, are you going to be like that? My wife is like, his parents were like that.
Yeah.
It's just funny because it's like a very common story of like a first generation Indian person growing up in the West. I've had so many friends of mine, Indian friends, that have had the same experience. We're pursuing, you know, we're kind of brought up in our community to become lawyers, doctors, engineers.
Yeah.
And if you go into the arts, they're like, why? I don't understand that. Like, that's not doctor engineering.
Do you think that part of that being brought up in that fashion is part of what kind of gives you the thick skin to keep doing it, even though when it's tough?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, you know, like I, all through my music pursuit, I did like electrical engineering.
Yeah.
So I was very, I grew up, my dad was, I remember one point my dad was like, he's like, fine, do what you want, but have a backup plan. That was his thing at one point. So I stuck with my engineering. I would take a year off. I'd go on tour. I'd go back to school, and I took my time, and that did teach me a good work ethic where I've always kept moving forward. And now that's why I don't believe in like roadblocks.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see roadblocks. I don't see things stopping me from doing what I want to do. And that's good and bad. I guess I could be stubborn that way, but if I believe in something, I'm not going to let anything stop me. And yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, my whole life has always been like, you can't do that.
I think that's the number one thing that gets me committed to something is when someone's like, it's not going to work. You can't do that. Yeah. And then yeah. I just get to be that, you know. Yeah.
No, I mean, I grew
irritated, you know, be like, I'll show you.
Like my whole, like when I was a kid, I mean, I was always hospitalized for my asthma. And my whole life was like, my mom would be like, don't leave the house. You're not allowed to do that. You can't do this. You're going to get an asthma attack. And so my whole life was kind of like, you can't do this because because of what you are. And so it's interesting. And then that's definitely, I mean, man, like I look at my kids and I think whatever they experience now will affect them for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
Right now is their formative years. You're kind of laying the foundation of who they will be. And I think about this lockdown that they're not in school, they're not seeing their friends. Like, what can we do to not like traumatize them for the rest of their life?
Well, first of all, you're a parent, you're definitely going to traumatize your kid.
Exactly. Yeah.
But
it's going to make them stronger.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, I was listening to a podcast the other day and they're talking about how like, you know, those ages from like 12 to 15, they're like, I don't feel any different. They're like, you know, I have more aches and pains, but like that is like the core of who I am was like in that age range.
Yeah. They're going to run with it then.
Yeah.
Definitely. yeah, who I am today is definitely all like the messed up childhood I had in some ways. Like, you know, like, yeah, definitely. Like, I'm definitely like a survivor in some ways in my mind. And I just keep going. So
do your parents now kind of appreciate what you're doing? And
oh yeah. Ways? Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, it was interesting. I mean, like my dad
was
like,
the playing on stage with Beck the key moment where they're like,
yeah, there's moments. I mean they saw, like, I mean, yeah, they're really proud of me now. I mean, I think the fact that I've got a family, I'm able to support my family, I'm able to pursue my dreams. Mm-hmm. You know, like growing up in that, I keep going, but you know, I keep saying Indian, but I'm sure any ethnic immigrant people experience in the West is similar. But like, your parents came here for a better life. Mm-hmm. You know, they came here with nothing. They worked hard. They expect you to do the same thing, but you're growing up half like one door in the West, one door in the East. And you're kind of influenced by your environment. And I forgot where I'm going with this, but yeah, no, but so yeah, so there's like, I mean,
but I mean, that's kind of part of, you almost want to be like, it's part of your parents doing such a good job at working hard that allows you to not have to work as hard.
But then you can work. No, but you yeah. have to work just as hard, but.
Well, maybe you, not in a different,
way. In fashion. Yeah. But I can pursue things I want to do with my life. I want to have a life that I'm happy with. I never wanted to be the guy that's like, oh, I'll wait until my dad was wait until you're retired. Then you can live your life. And I remember when he retired, it was retired. He was forced into retirement after working this factory for 30 years as a manager there. And he just felt like he was cast aside.
Right.
And soon after his retirement, he had a quadruple bypass.
Yeah.
And I remember after all that, I was talking to him one day. He's like, man, he's like, I didn't say he wasted his life, but he's like, he waited too long to live his life. And then he went to me, he's like, what you're doing, do what you can now. Don't wait until it's too late. And he actually, it was nice because it was the moment where he kind of acknowledged that how I was living my life was, he actually think that's someone, you know, he can look back on his life and see
almost
what I'm
like
doing.
He was a little jealous. Like,
yeah. No, it was nice. It was nice. And I remember I just felt nice. I'm like, okay. I'm like, I shouldn't feel bad about wanting to, you know, I mean, my wife puts up with me going on tour for weeks at a time and stuff, but you know, when I'm home, I'm present. And so, yeah, no, it's important. I mean, you need to live a balanced life. I think that's what I've tried to do, and just not feel like, I have a lot of friends that are like, man, it's like, I don't know what I'm doing my life. I work all the time. So unhappy. And because people get so, the society, your parents, corporations, you know, school, they force you into this tunnel vision. Think you have to go to school. You have to get a job. You have to pay taxes. You have to do this.
Yeah.
But they don't like capitalism, right? It doesn't allow you the room to explore and find out what you really want to do in life. It's just there to usher you along into the factories.
Right. Yeah. My 9-to-5 job, like at the end of every day, you know, cause I work in marketing, and there's kind of like a little marketing corner where all our cubicles are. And, you know, at the end of the day, everyone kind of checks in. They're like, hey, what do you got going on? Whatever. And they're always like, oh, Andy, you know, where are you off to today? And I'm like, oh, I'm running an event at this brewery, or I'm going to record with this person, or I'm going to record with that person. And they're like, I don't know how you do it. I'm like, I don't know how you just go home and sit. I'm exactly. Like, so this quarantine is killing me, because it's like, there's nothing to do. But it's just like, I don't understand how you can just go home and sit and watch, I'm probably going to get some heat for this, The Office over and over and over again. I mean, it's a decent show, but it's just like, that is just torture to me to just sit there and
I guess
not be active.
I guess you and like a lot of people are lucky that they found things that they enjoy doing,
yeah,
and they can actually keep doing it. And yeah, no. And it's important. It's important to have a creative outlet, you know, something that you feel like you're giving something. And I think that's why there's a lot of unhappy people in the world, because they've never been allowed to actually explore that.
And it's always interesting if you see those unhappy people find that moment where they're actually doing something where they are happy. You know, my father, yeah, the same way. He was a blue collar worker and whatever. And, he was, you know, big fan of Irish music, and we'd go out to see an Irish band, or he'd go play golf, and you'd see him and he'd be like a different person for that,
yeah,
time, because, yeah, he'd be legitimately happy and be like, you know, you can, yeah, do that all the time. You can be happy exactly, all the time.
That's it. You need to set up your life that you can actually go to that place.
Yeah.
More often than not.
So quick before we kind of wrap this up, I mean, it's kind of, I felt like it flew by. Where can people go online to check out your music and
oh, well,
live streams and,
yeah, it's,
you know, well, all the promotional stuff.
It's the website's elephantstone.ca, and then I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and all. It's all, if you search for Elephant Stone,
it should come up.
Yeah, yeah. There's, yeah, a song by this band, the Stone Roses, that I love called Elephant Stone, but I think we showed first in Google.
Did you name yourself after that song, or?
Yeah, well, when I started the band, I had this like sandstone statue of Ganesh. Mm-hmm. He's the Hindu god of new beginnings and prosperity. So I kind of just liked that, and I was like, oh, maybe I can name the band like Elephant. There's a band called, and then I was like, Elephant Stone. I'm like, oh, and it's a Stone Roses song. And so, unfortunately, the Stone Roses are like gods and England, and then people get really annoyed. They're like, how dare you deface such a sacrilege song by naming my blah,
just
blah,
pretend
blah,
like you never heard of them.
Like, yeah, I'm like, who? Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, but we're if you Google Elephant Stone, you'll find me in the band.
I just have a question. So you're in Montreal. Is there like how's the music scene there, where it's like a bilingual city, because you have the French speaking and English, yeah, speaking, and is that something you have to navigate? Do you try to like incorporate French into something?
Oh, we're all, like, it's all pretty integrated, like the French and English. I mean, right now, I mean, seeing the scene was very separated, like disparate rather, when in the 90s. And then at one point it just started melding into one. And right now it's like most of my band was French at one point.
Yeah.
Like Quebecois. And then it's always, everyone's playing in each other's bands, and there's a lot of great music happening in the town. I mean, it's a big college town, so you get people come from out of town. I mean, Arcade Fire, right?
It's a great town to hang out in.
Yeah.
It was a while ago, but it doesn't feel like Vegas, but it's that Vegas, New York, where nothing shuts. Like,
yeah, exactly. Well, everything's shut now.
Well, yeah,
it's like 28 days later right now. So.
Yeah, I mean, on a normal day, like there's always
exactly,
something open.
Exactly. No. But yeah, no, I mean, Montreal's, it's all about arts and culture here. So, I mean, it's great. Yeah. There's so much, a lot of music fans here. It's nice.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah. So our listeners should check you guys out, and I hope you guys, the best of luck and stay healthy, because you are definitely infected. You have to be.
I'm asthmatic. It's just the wheeze.
I feel like everyone who coughs now has to like explain. No, it's allergies. It's allergies.
It's allergies. It's allergies. Yeah. Exactly. I don't go. I don't leave my house anymore. So there you go.
Yeah. No, but thanks for taking the time to talk to me, man.
Thank you, man.
And I'll try to check out your live streams.
Great. Take care, man.
Awesome. Thanks. Bye. See you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. You can find us on all social medias at InebriArt, except for Instagram, we're at InebriArt6. You can email us with your questions, complaints, and whatnot at InebriArt@yahoo.com. And if you're looking for more podcasts, you can check out the other podcasts on our network, Retro Redoctopus, America's Hometown Horror, and, of course, Bar Talk, Old Colony, and InebriArt Podcast, the original. So check those out and subscribe and comment so we can reach more people. And thanks for listening.